Before we move to Numbers, I want briefly to talk with you about some of the implications of the Levitical system for the New Testament and the New Testament understanding of atonement. Unfortunately, we can do this only briefly. We will take this up further in the extra sessions. But I think there are some things that ought to be emphasized for the group as a whole. The first of these, which I think we've mentioned already, is that the Levitical system anticipates the atoning work of Christ based on the foreknowledge of God. I think I need not emphasize how important the foreknowledge of God is for many, many things in these books that we're studying and in the scriptures as a whole. And foreknowledge really means foresight. God sees in advance what will happen. Of course, biblically, what happens is based on the human use of freedom. There's no negation of freedom because of divine foreknowledge. And so, as over against what we often perceive with regard to the relationship between the Levitical system and New Testament events, particularly atoning events, the causal nexus does not run from the Levitical system to the New Testament events. The system does not produce the events. Rather, God foresees the events and adapts the system and ordains the system in anticipation of the events. So the causal nexus runs from the events as cause to the system as effect. Now, by the way, the first view is a Reformed view. It's deterministic. Because the Levitical system was what it was, certain things had to happen in the New Testament. And of course, the moment you have determinism, you have no freedom. The moment you have no freedom, you have no responsibility. Those of us who are Western Arminians ought to realize that the bind into which you get when you have that kind of system. This second view, I think, allows for the kind of freedom which the scriptures indicate is absolutely indispensable, and which we as Wesleyan Arminians ought to recognize as indispensable if we want to emphasize the human responsibility. Now, let me look at a verse with you very quickly, namely Hebrews 9:22, which is often cited in connection with this matter as a basis really for supporting, presumably, a determinism, and it is often cited as describing what happens in the New Testament. But that is not the case if you look at Hebrews 22 in context. It's a description of the Levitical system. Indeed, under the law, almost everything, not the almost, everything is purified with blood. That's the cleansing idea. And without the shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness of sins. That's the old covenant, under the law. Now, as I say, this was designed because God foresaw that when Christ came, he would be murdered. And there would be shedding of blood as part of the process of making possible atonement for sins. So, please do not use this verse out of context. Not a description of the new covenant. It's a description of the old covenant, which was designed in anticipation of the new covenant. And so, if I may adapt a statement by Thomas Aquinas, which relates to Scripture, and which, by the way, is very important in relation to Scripture, only God, as the author of Scripture, and there we might say as the author of the Levitical covenant, foresees the different stages of salvation history and adapts the human words or the human rituals to them in advance. That's the foresight, foreknowledge. Now, let me make a hypothetical statement, which I tend to back off of, because scriptures do not deal with hypothetical statements or abstractions, but concretions. If the New Testament history had been different, I think God would have designed the Levitical system differently. That indicates that God adapts in advance what he foresees will happen. What he foresees will happen does not determine in advance what will happen. You see the difference between those two? That's very, very important. By the way, this relates to scriptural prophecy too, or the fulfillment of scriptures by Christ. This is what Aquinas is really talking about. You know, very often the scriptures say in the New Testament, this certain things happened, this was in order to fulfill the scriptures. And then you have a scriptural quotation. Well, what happened is that God foresaw in advance what would happen and superintended even the language of scripture in order to make possible this kind of accord or fulfillment in order in turn to support the messiahship of Jesus. These statements provide what C.H. Dodd calls the testimonia, which the Jews needed in order to believe that Messiah, that Jesus was the Messiah, in view of his suffering history and his dying history, which did not accord with their understandings of what happened to the Messiah. Now the second thing, and I can't do these things thoroughly, but I suggest them anyway. Atonement is ultimately bilateral. It's a two-way process, not a one-way process. The Levitical system stresses the role of human offerings. The New Testament indicates that God himself must also make an offering. Thus, Jesus is described as that offering, and is described, for example, in John 21 as, John 1:29, as the Lamb of God. This is God's offering in the process. So offerings must be made both by humans, but also by God. And what the Levitical system anticipates is the human offering, which, by the way, continues. We alluded, for example, to Romans 12:1-2. Human beings now, they needed back then too, but now need to offer not animals, but living sacrifices to God themselves, their lives, their bodies to which their lives are expressed. But God also must make an offering. So it's bilateral. Now, whether this anticipates penal propitiatory satisfaction is a question that we'll deal with in these extra sections. I have a question mark there. Three, the New Testament fulfills and therefore transcends the Levitical system. Therefore, the relation between them is paradoxical. Pardon me. There are similarities, such as the continued need for mediation, the high priesthood of Jesus, but there are also dissimilarities, such as the cessation of human mediation. Now, what I'm warning you against is not pressing the Levitical system too far, particularly in those areas where there are dissimilarities, because if you do, then you misunderstand the relationship between the two. You must ask, where are they similar, and at the point of similarity, then try to understand the New Testament in light of the Old Testament. Now, four, the atoning work of Christ is described in both Levitical language and in pre-Levitical and non-Levitical language. Now, this is very important because we often stress only the Levitical language used in the New Testament to describe atonement. But we do have Levitical language in Romans 3, 3:25, and Hebrews. Hebrews has a lot of Levitical language. But you have pre-Levitical language, and the most significant element there has to do with the emphasis on Christ as the Passover lamb, to which I have just alluded in John 1:29. At least I think that in John 1:29, the allusion is to the Paschal lamb. And certainly the fact that Christ died during the Passover, and that the Passover meal was used to interpret the death of Christ in terms of blood and body. By the way, unleavened bread was used for the Feast of Unleavened Bread. So it's either the Feast of the Passover and unleavened bread that are fulfilled in the crucifixion. And Paul rightly describes Christ as the Paschal lamb. It's very, very significant. Now, there is no clear evidence that the Paschal lamb was expiatory. As a matter of fact, as I indicated, it's pre-Levitical. But it had to do with an expression of faith in God and an offering to God in order that the nation might be passed over with regard to the slaying of the firstborn. But there is no indication of atonement, expiatory atonement in connection with the Passover. So that's very, very significant. Then fifth, the atoning work of Christ is retroactive. Therefore, Old Testament atonement is based on God's foreknowledge again of the atoning work of Christ. Now we emphasize that there was atonement back in the Levitical system. But as the author of Hebrews says, the blood of bulls and goats cannot provide the basis for atonement. Therefore, God foresaw the atoning work of Christ and treated the Old Testament people on the basis of that atoning work. And the New Testament in Romans 3 and in Hebrews 9 thus describes the atoning work of Christ as retroactive. And by the way, the book of the Revelation describes Christ as the Lamb, and incidentally that's the interesting description of Christ in the Revelation, picking up the Lamb of God in John 1, the Lamb of God who was slain from the foundation of the world. And again, we have to see that not on the basis of determinism, but on the basis of foreknowledge. In God's mind, the crucifixion which he foresaw became then the basis on which he acted historically, even before the crucifixion. What God foreknows becomes the basis for his action. Biblically speaking. The atoning work of Christ, number 6, is viewed more holistically than suggested by the Levitical system. Now here is one of the dissimilarities. We must not restrict the atoning work of Christ as described by the New Testament solely in terms of the Levitical system, otherwise we get into dissimilarities. The Levitical system emphasized sacrificial death and mediation, which partially anticipates what happens in the New Testament. The New Testament, on the other hand, when you look at the New Testament fully, and this is very, very significant, involves the incarnation, for example, the kenosis passage of Philippians 2, the life of Christ, his life of complete and perfect obedience. Had Christ disobeyed, his death would not have been atoning. He died because he obeyed God. That's why the religious leaders opposed him. His death, to be sure, but his resurrection, for example, in almost one breath, Paul in Romans 3 talks about the expiatory blood of Christ as the basis for atonement, and then in 4:25 of Romans he says, he died for our trespasses and was raised for our justification, or atonement. The ascension, the session, the intercession, of course Hebrews brings the changes on that one, and I think we have to try to understand atonement in light of the fact that the author of Hebrews says that Christ is interceding right now, this very moment, and if Christ ceased interceding now, there would be no atonement. Now we sing, 'tis done, the great transaction's done. It is not done. He is mediating, this is a mediating function. He is mediating on the basis of his death as part of this total picture. Not just death isolated from everything else. Death is sometimes used to stand for the whole because, you know, you can't recite everything every time you want to talk about the expiatory work of Christ. You can't recite incarnation and pre-incarnation and life and death and ascension and resurrection. You know, that kind of thing would become cumbersome every time you want to talk about the atoning work of Christ. So death is lifted up as a very dramatic part that represents the whole. And intercession is part of this whole. And indeed, in the Old Testament, and here is where there is a similarity between the Old Testament and the atoning work of Christ, there are two elements involved in atonement. One element is the element of sacrifice, killing of the animal, although we saw that even a cereal offering could be used for atonement, which means that killing of the animal is not a defensive. But the second thing was mediation on the basis of the sacrifice. As we emphasized, had the high priest on the Day of Atonement simply killed the animal and then walked away, there would have been no atonement. He had to mediate by going into the Holy of Holies and in effect interceding for the people on the basis of the sacrifice. Now Christ's intercession, Christ's high priestly intercession, which is going on now, is this mediation without which his death would have been meaningless. That's why you have to have a resurrection. Christ remaining dead could not provide atonement. You have to have ascension to what Hebrews calls the holy sanctuary, the spiritual tabernacle, heavenly tabernacle, and you have to have intercession. That intercession will continue, and by the way, Paul also captures the concept of intercession in Romans 8. That intercession continues until the very end, and indeed then is the basis for eschatological atonement. That's when atonement takes place ultimately. When Christ, as the judge, says, atonement has been made for your sin in the eschaton, therefore you are one of the people of God, and you will experience God eternally. So, we need to view this thing holistically. I think one of our problems in relation to atonement is that we have tended to isolate, particularly the death of Christ, from this total picture. And the moment you do that, you can get into all kinds of distortions that I think need to be avoided if the New Testament is to have its say with regard to what provides for atonement. And I indicate here that it might also even include the pre-incarnate activity of Christ. That's one that needs to take a very holistic and unitary concept of the work of Christ. And then, very quickly, 7, the atoning work of Christ, like the Levitical system, may involve a means of averting the wrath of God rather than expressing it. There's a basis for holding that what God says in the Levitical system is that if you don't do these things, then you will experience my wrath. But if you do these things, you will avert my wrath. Not because I am expressing my wrath, because I don't think the Levitical offerings are an expression of God's wrath. They are offerings to God. They're not the judgment of God on the animal. There's no indication that God is judging the animal wrathfully instead of the offerer. They are offerings. They are gifts by the offerer to God. Recognition, as we put it, of the reality of sin, the seriousness of sin, the importance of covenant relationships, the fact that this means will provide atonement. It's very important to keep covenant relations going, etc. You see, it's an offering, so it's a means of averting the wrath. And I state again that really the main place, if not the only place, where you have wrath in Leviticus is in Leviticus 10, where the rituals were violated for averting wrath. Then you had wrath. Thus it may be viewed as vicarious instead of substitutionary, thus without equivalence. And I'm using these words, which may be taken as absolutely synonymous, but I'm distinguishing between them. But because Christ died, we don't have to die. That doesn't mean that he suffered precisely the same penalty that was designed and intended for us. That's substitution. You have to have equivalence with substitution. In substitution, you have to describe what the penalty was that the sinner had upon him, and then you have to describe the suffering of Christ in precisely the same way. And I think it is clear that the penalty that Christ suffered was not eternal. It was for 3 days. That's far from eternity, isn't it? Far from eternity. If you're talking about an eternal penalty for the sinner and 3 days for Christ, you're not talking about the same thing whatsoever. To say nothing of the fact that there are serious questions as to whether Christ suffered the spiritual penalty of separation from the Father. And I base this on my interpretation of the cry of dereliction on the cross, my God, why have you forsaken me? If you accept penal satisfaction and equivalence, substitution and equivalence, of course you say because the penalty which the sinner was to suffer was separation from God, then somehow God had to be separated from Christ, who suffered the equivalent and substitutionary penalty. But then you come at that statement with the presupposition that it has to mean separation. Forsakenness has to mean separation. There are some other possibilities there that ought to be looked at and may indeed be viable if you're open-minded with regard to possible meanings. I don't mean to be accusatory in that kind of statement. I'm simply being descriptive, I think, and what it means. It may mean separation, but it may mean other things as well. And then finally, the atoning work of Christ, like the Levitical atonement, may need to be seen in personal, interpersonal, and relational terms rather than the legal penal terms. As we pointed out, the penalty of the law was not set aside by the Levitical system. Indeed, as we pointed out, there are some who hold the Levitical system did not even apply to high-handed sin. But in any case, there was forgiveness, and yet at the same time, the legal penalty was carried out. At least most of the time. Now, sometimes it wasn't, which is another proposition with regard to the Old Testament Levitical system. For example, in the case of David. David committed capital crimes, but was never killed for the capital crimes. He was judged, but not killed. So, by the way, when we talk about inexorable law in the Old Testament, we're not talking about the data as we have those data. We're talking about an abstraction. And when you get into abstractions in treating biblical data and biblical meanings, you get in trouble. Because, of course, the scriptures are historical in their orientation, and history is concrete, not abstract. So, the emphasis may be, then, in both the Levitical system, which is preparatio for Christ and the fulfillment of Christ, not paying a legal penalty, but doing what is necessary for interpersonal reconciliation. That, I think, is the essence of the Levitical system. What is necessary to make right one's relationship with God in spite of the fact that one has sinned and has violated that relationship. Now, very quickly in conclusion, let me underline what is very, very important. I think in all this, and I hope one day to write a book on this subject, because I think this is a key to biblical understanding. A personal being has interpersonal relationships with other personal beings. That's the meaning of covenants. And by the way, you have covenants between human beings of essentially the same sort, not completely the same sort, but essentially the same sort, the same word is used. Covenants between human beings, for example, between Jacob and Laban. Jacob was ready to leave and Laban was going to hurt him and decided not to. They made a covenant between them. Now, that's a parity covenant, and both parties do equivalent things. Of course, in God's covenant, there's not parity because God does far more than human beings do, although the relationship, as you pointed out, is bilateral. Human beings are personal beings who have interpersonal relationships with other personal beings, human and divine. That's involved, as we indicated initially, in the Imago Dei, that both God and human beings are personal. That's their essential similarity, and therefore capable of having interpersonal relationships. Therefore, and this applies to the atonement and to all kinds of other things, biblically, God's relation to us and our relation to Him are best understood not in legal terms, but, in other words, by the use of law as a paradigm or as a model, but by the use of the analogy of human persons and their interpersonal relations. In one of the extra sessions, I will set forth a possible view of atonement, which is based on this concept, which I think is what the Levitical system is really all about. It's a question of interpersonal relationships, not a question of paying a legal penalty and being exiled from a legal penalty.
When the scripture says Christ paid for our sins,
we'll be talking about that in the extra sessions. I wish we had time here, but we really need to move on to numbers here today. So I think what I'll do here is simply leave this with you for your own rumination, and we'll expound on these things in these two sessions we'll have the next 2 weeks. And as I say, those tapes will be on reserve for you to listen to. And if you have any questions beyond that, I'll be glad to talk to you. But I would urge you to listen to those tapes first. As a background for the kinds of things that we say. Okay, I wish we had more time, as I say, but our time is fleeting, as you know, and we have Numbers and Deuteronomy to do. We can't do anywhere near justice to both of them in Deuteronomy, so I think we ought to take the time now to move on these two books. So let's move on to the book of Numbers and begin at least surveying that book as a whole today. Let's try to get at the structural units of the book as a whole and the primary laws operative to bind those units together in the book as a whole, along with the materials that they are used with, and then questions based on those laws and their materials, and finally look at strategic areas in the book as a whole. Let me get us started here. I would say that one of the main laws at work in the book of Numbers is the law of the recurrence of preparation with at least partial realization not complete realization, and therein lies a very significant tale. The recurrence of preparation and then partial realization, because what you have in 1:1 to 2:10 is, I'm sorry, 10:10, I'll say 2:10, 10:10, is preparation to leave, to travel, and to conquer Canaan. And we see that in terms of the military census, which takes place at the very outset, in terms of the plans for encampment. It's quite a mob to move, 600,000 men, along with women and children, quite a mob to move, and you can imagine the chaos that would have existed had they not known where to camp and how to pick up and go, etc. So preparations were made for that kind of thing. And then you have other preparations made, which I hope we can have the chance to come. So you have preparation for leaving. And by the way, this preparation for leaving takes place at Sinai, still at Sinai, so that the experience at Sinai, which takes about circa 1 year, and left after 1 year and the second in the second month, goes back in terms of the literature to Exodus 19 to 40 and to the whole book of Leviticus. So all of that material is presented as having taken place at Sinai. Now what you have in 10:11, and how far that goes is a question here, because for one thing, another law may be involved in this that we need to look at. But in any case, let's at least temporarily say, through chapter 21. You have them traveling wandering, and by the way, there's a difference between them. The first one was purposeful. They were headed toward the promised land. That's where the cloud was going. But as you know, they decided not to go where the cloud was going. And therein lay their tragedy. And then some conquest. The major conquests come in 21 in relation to Og, the king of Bashan, and Sion, the king of Heshbon. Those are the two major conquests that take place in 21. So this preparation is made for this, although this was not fulfilled preparation, because this preparation was for conquering Canaan, which they didn't do, and don't do in this book, and don't do in the subsequent book which you're looking at. It doesn't happen in Deuteronomy either. It happens where? In Joshua. And now, in 22 following, you have preparation again. This is the second preparation, first preparation. Preparation for entering, conquering the land. Now you have some realization here, because, of course, you have the settling of some of the tribes east of the Jordan. So you have some realization here. And in these materials, you could divide the materials into what's preparation and what's some realization. In any case, the emphasis is on preparation in terms of the amount of material that you have here. So, and of course, as I say, therein lies the story, because you have to have a second preparation, including a second census, military census. Of course, the first military census, it happens back here in chapter 1, where the men who are able to go to war are counted, so they know how many men to depend upon as they plan battles. There's a second census where? Chapter 26. So the recurring of the census is indicative of what's happening here. And the second census has to be taken by? Yeah, because most of these people died. So they're off the scene. You have to find out what the second generation looks like. So, as I say, therein lies the tale of numbers. And by the way, the name numbers refers to these two censuses. Part of these preparations, and as part of the story of this book, book as a whole, of the second census, not needed had this first generation obeyed God. Now, some of them would have passed off the scene because of age, but there wouldn't have been this wiping out, virtual wiping out totally of this first generation if something hadn't happened yet. That happened in the wandering. Now, this period, which, by the way, could have been much shorter, if you find out the beginning of the book of Deuteronomy, took about 39 years. No reason in the world why it should have taken 39 years to move from Kadesh Barnea, where they were here in Numbers 13 and 14, to Canaan. I mean, they were almost there. And we'll give you some, take some time next time to look at the geography again. They were almost there. No reason in the world why it should take 39 years to move from Kadesh Barnea to the land of Canaan. But it did. And that leads us to the second major relationship here, and that is, let me raise some questions here with regard to the first one. First of all, I hope you see these are different colors that I have available, and maybe you can make them over again. What preparations are made to leave Sinai, and what does each involve? Of course, points to this opening area. We've already talked about the military census and the encampment plans. How do they prepare for travel and conquest? Note now, we ask the definitive questions first, including a modal form of the definitive question. You focus all these questions on the laws. And by the way, I don't quite have all of your Exodus surveys back. I apologize for that, but I'll keep pecking away. So if you haven't gotten yours back, because I haven't gotten to it yet. Then the rational question, why are these preparations made? Why these and not others? Are there common elements in the preparation? If so, what are they and what do they involve? If there are common elements, why are they used? What is involved in the realization? And how does it, or does it not, fulfill the preparation? And what are the implications? That focuses on the preparatory element. And realization, and I will focus on recurrence. What preparations are made 21 following, and what does each mean? Focusing on second preparation first. How do they prepare for traveling and entering the land? Why these preparations? Why not others? If there are recurring elements between the preparations, what do they involve and why do they recur? What are the similarities and differences between the two preparations? Why the recurrence of preparation, and what are the implications? See, what I'm doing is to take the major law in this combination, namely preparation and realization, and I'm dealing with each of those two elements, in each case separately, then asking about recurrence and the relationship between these recurring elements of preparation and realization. See what I'm doing in these questions? And I'm trying to do it systematically, by emphasizing a systematic approach. I'm not trying to lock you into something. What I'm trying to do is to get your mind thinking in a certain pattern, and one of the reasons is that you'll include all the questions you need to include. Otherwise, if you wander around, you don't know where you are. Okay. So if you have a systematic way of doing it, you'll cover the territory as far as asking the right questions and asking all the questions necessary, focusing on the law and the materials for which the law was used. As you noticed about traveling and conquest, etc., we're talking about these specific materials. Okay, any questions on that? Yes, that's right.
The way I separated the last segment was from 26 on, based on the new census that I'm using the law.
We'll come to that in just a moment. Yeah, there's some ambiguity there, and one, if we had the time, we could list the arguments pro and con as to where you make the break. It relates really to the second major law, I would find, which is also a complex law, and that is the recurrence of tests. And Now, it's clear where the first pivot comes. Where does that come? 13 and 14 is where the first pivot comes. Here where the spines are sent in, and they come back with two reports, and the majority report is accepted, not the minority report, which really means that what God was preparing them for here, in terms of conquest, and also in terms of traveling toward the land of Canaan, is simply nullified temporarily. So what you have then is the judgment of God as a result of this refusal to obey God at Kadesh Barnea. This is the Kadesh Barnea experience. Now, there is a second pivot, because this book is not all about the judgment of God for what happened in Kadesh Barnea, is it? God is working against them here, but at some point he begins working for them. Okay? But it's a change of direction. Now the question is, where does it come? This is the question you raised, right? There is some basis for saying it begins here in 26 with a new census. On the other hand, there is some basis for holding that it comes here somewhere in this vicinity. In fact, it might divide 21 and 22 up. By the way, here they have arrived at Moab. That's the other geographical element we ought to add here. They're at Sinai. Here they're in the wilderness. And now they are here in and, let's put it the other way, around and in Moab. And we'll get to the geography the next time, and have more time. Which is on the threshold of Canaan, where they are in Deuteronomy. Now, they've arrived on the threshold of Canaan. As I say, they've settled the 2.5 tribes on the east of the Jordan here. Now, there are several reasons for taking the view that you've indicated, Ray. One is that there is a second census here that might indicate the change in the movement. You also have the Baal Peor episode in 25, where there is judgment, but note there are only 25,000 killed, which is a drop in the bucket in relation to the total nation. That's quite different from wiping out this whole generation. Okay. I think there are clear evidences of God working on their behalf here, earlier. Not only in terms of what happens with the solution for the serpents here, with a bronze serpent providing a means of escaping this plague, but also the victories over Og and Sion, which, by the way, you'll find at the beginning of Deuteronomy, are cited as major victories as over against the judgment of God at Kadesh Barnea. In other words, I think Deuteronomy emphasizes this contrast, that indicates a radical difference between God and his relation to the nation as between these two episodes. And then, of course, you have the Balaam section, 22 to 24, when God stops this prophet, who was sent by Balak to curse the people, and the prophet ends up doing what? Blessing the people, you see? So I think God is now working on their behalf. There's a shift here. I think the shift takes place here. And though there are temporary acts of disobedience, and by the way, those things would go on, even in the conquest you have, for example, at Ai, two episodes, one disbelief and judgment, and then belief and the conquest of Ai, you see. So you have these vacillations with regard to Israel. So that's not strange. I think the major thrust here has to do with God working on behalf of Israel in order now to bring them back from this tragedy of the wilderness, wandering and the judgment, and beginning to move toward the conquest of Canaan. And I think the locale is significant there. Now, let me just indicate very quickly here, in closing, I'm sorry we can't take more time here. A third law would be the recurrence causation, and you could add, let's say causal contrast. Because what you have throughout the book are two causal relationships, namely, obedience leads to blessing, we've already talked about that, and disobedience leads to curse. Now, for example, we've talked about, of course, the disobedience there at Baal Peor. Of course, you have Korah's rebellion. here, which was also disobedience and led to a curse. You also have certain preparatory events here where the people murmur and God judges them. They want meat, for example. And God judges them. By the way, you also have Moses' sin in chapter 20, where he's told to speak to the rock from which water comes, and he gets angry and strikes the rock because he's getting completely exasperated with the people, and you don't blame him. If these people were the people of your parish, how would you feel? Over 40 years, I mean over a period of 40 years, not just 3 years or 5 years, but 40 years, how would you feel? Pretty exasperated, wouldn't you? And once in a while you'd blow your cool too. I would too. He blew his cool, and of course he would judge. He would not see the land of Canaan. I mean, he would not enter the land of Canaan. He would see it from outside the land of Canaan. He would not enter it. And of course, in Deuteronomy, he dies before the people are led by Joshua into the land of Canaan. And let me just indicate now another movement here to describe this movement. But let me indicate, finally, summarization. In chapter 33, we have geographical summarization, essentially. Here you have organization. Here you have disorganization. And here you have reorganization. Is, I think, a good way of describing the movement here. And this corresponds with this first category. So I would say those are the four primary laws that dominate the book as a whole. We'll talk briefly about strategic errors the next time, and then what we'll do is get more in more detail by way of beginning to answer some of these questions that we've raised. We'll see you tomorrow then at noon, if you are able to come, and then on Thursday at the usual hour. Hand in your papers on numbers, please. Thank you.
How can this be allowed when it's a puzzle contrast?
Well, it includes this area insofar as they obey God. They obey God here. They lay gentle rites. They obey the commandments, etc. You have when they obey with regard to Passover, etc. So all of this really involves obedience and then the disobedience with the vengeance, you say. Then you learn that some obedience, mainly obedience, some disobedience, although also disobedience. Chapter 9, it captures the essence of the preparation which happens here in the opening materials. Preparation for departure with all of that involves in terms of traveling and also breaking camp, traveling, and then the conquest. These other areas are directly related to the laws. If you have two pivots, 13 and 14 and 21, those would, by the nature of their role, structurally be strategic. And summarization in 33 would also be strategic. That's a geographical kind of summarization. That would be important. Now we'll be looking at 9 and 13 and 14 here today as we examine numbers a little further. Any questions on what you have here, the way of strategic areas, or about strategic areas as such? Yeah. Well, as you noted here, you have the movement toward 13 and 14, which is essentially one of obedience, and they're on their way. That, of course, turns things around, leads to the wilderness experience and destruction of the people. And I see in 21, particularly, the regard to the victories over Og and Sion, the two kings, there in the Transjordan area, the reversal of the process, so that now instead of God's fighting against them, as it were, which is what was happening in the wilderness, he is now fighting for them. So that begins the reversal of the process. Indeed, even in relation to the bronze serpent by which he saves the people from their sins, you have indicated that reversal. But I think primarily would be that those two major battles which are mentioned in Deuteronomy by way of contrast to this. Any other questions on the strategic areas? All right. Let me talk briefly about the geography here so that we have that in mind as we look at these areas, particularly 13 and 14, but also what happens in the last materials. If you follow, can you see this all right? If you follow the traditional view, Sinai, which is where the people were, beginning with Exodus 19 through Leviticus, through the beginning of Numbers, is located down here in the southern area of the wilderness of Sin. And then Kadesh Barnea, where they arrived in Numbers 13 and 14, from which they sent spies into the land, up in this direction, is located here. So they had traveled from Sinai to Kadesh Barnea within just a few chapters, and are now very close to the land of Canaan, obviously, although they need to cross the Jordan and come in from the east side. Now the wandering area is somewhere in here, and it's not clear exactly where they went, but they went south here to Etzion Geber. How they went up north is debatable, because it's hard to locate the places mentioned, as is true of much of what you have here. You have a lot of geographical indications, but they're hard to locate. The King's Highway is mentioned. Let me show you another transparency here. The King's Highway is mentioned in Numbers, which would be here. Here is Etzion Geber. Here is the King's Highway going up to Eb-Avarim. An alternate route here might be to the east of the King's Highway and coming in here and going up here. So it's unclear how they went up in this area. But what is clear is that in the last unit of Numbers, they are here in the area of Moab, which of course means they're just about ready to take the land. And it's in this same area that the book of Deuteronomy takes place. The locale of Deuteronomy is static. Essentially, it takes place here in this area. And of course, Moses dies on Mount Nebo outside of Canaan here. But it's in this area that the end of Numbers takes place and Deuteronomy takes place. So here you find the people in Moab, and that's then true to the Deuteronomy.
In the first part of the Exodus, when it said they rode in the Red Sea, we end up
One of the problems is the meaning of that in terms of finding out what the geographical locale is. It could involve coming south toward the Red Sea as here identified, as over against the Sea of Reeds, which is here up north. That was the beginning of their journey, and that could not, of course, be down in this area, not even in the Gulf of Suez, what's called the Gulf of Suez area here. The question is whether it means the Sea of Reeds up here, or whether it means the Red Sea down here. That's one of the graphical questions that's not easy to resolve, but based on my knowledge.
Well, if you had a question, why did you make the divisions 10 and 11?
Not primarily. It's really historical and therefore literary reasons, and that is that here they're preparing to depart, and of course here they depart. So that's the major break there. Now within this area in the literature, you have this pivot here, I'll look at in just a few moments. So I think I think you have to ask yourself, what is the major element here? Is it the element of moving now away from not only Sinai, the locale, but all that was happening here, which we were preparing them for their departure, as well as for what happened in the conquest? So they're getting ready, they're being gotten ready by God for life in Canaan, as well as for reaching Canaan, taking Canaan. So it's that element that I think is more dominant here, and that's why I put it here, where we're going to say putting it here. In addition, of course, as I indicate, you have certain episodes of murmuring here and disobedience, which anticipate this is a genuine possibility. As a matter of fact, we found that same kind of thing previously. So that this tends to belong with this, I think. We're preparing you for what happened in 13 and 14, although, as I said the other day, if they hadn't done what was done in 13 and 14, the sin of fear would not have caused the destruction in the wilderness quantity. So that's the reason behind it. But as in all cases where you have various possibilities, what you have to do is to list the pros and cons based on evidence as to which tends to support which possibility, and then make a judgment if possible as to where the preponderance of evidence lies. Any other questions on this? All right. Now, when we surveyed the whole, we asked some survey questions, for example, with regard to this opening unit. What were the preparations for departure and conquest? What did they mean? Why were they made? What did they imply, etc.? Now, what I want to do is to begin answering those questions by looking at the parts, certain parts here, insofar as we have time today. When you look at the preparatory material here in 1:1 to 10:10, you find two kinds of things occurring. You find in chapter 1 the military census, the counting of every male from 20 years old and upward who is able to go forth to war, as is indicated in 1:3. And of course that happens with regard to the various tribes, and the numbers are given. And the total is given at the end of the unit in verse 40. So you have a military census, which obviously is important if you're going to plan military strategy. How big is our army? How strong is our army? What kind of battles can we fight successfully, etc.? And then, of course, you have in chapter 2 the instructions with regard to encampment. Who's on the east side and the south side and the northwest side and the north side? And by the way, the various tribes face the tabernacle. Although, as we shall see, immediately around the tabernacle were the various sons of Levi and their tribes, which are mentioned in 3. And then you have also the indication an indication later on of how they are to break camp and march, etc. So what you have are certain instructions, primarily in 1 to 2, involving what we might call human physical preparation. This would need to happen. Say they need to know how many soldiers they have. They need to have some plan for encamping and breaking camp, etc. Otherwise you'd have chaos. Whether they were involved in a covenant or not, whether they were a covenant people or not. So you have certain human physical preparations. But there's another dimension which is much more dominant here, and that involves divine spiritual preparation. You begin to get that toward the end of chapter 1 when the Levites are not numbered among the soldiers, those able to go to war, in 47 of chapter 1. But the Levites were not numbered. For the Lord said to Moses, only the tribe of Levi you shall not number, and you shall not take a census of them among the people of Israel, but appoint the Levites over the tabernacle of the testimony, etc. Now, I go back into ancient history. World War II, there was a classification of people. It was 4D. There were various interpretations of what D stood for. But the classification was for ministers in preparation. Now, the moment you exempt certain people from military matters, You're saying, aren't you, particularly when those people serve in spiritual capacities, that it's important that there be proper spiritual activities among the people, even though you lose some soldiers, lose some military strength. So the Levites are exempted, and they are numbered now as a separate group in chapter 3, and their duties or charges are given them with regard to the various families among the Levites. Sons of Levi, Gershon, Kohath, Merari. And indeed you have more of that kind of thing in terms of the tasks of the Levites in chapter 4. Let's look quickly at the rest of the chapters. You have primarily in 5 laws concerning jealousy. What happens when a husband suspects that a wife has committed adultery, etc., becomes jealous. Then you have the Nazarite vow in chapter 6, the vow taken by these special people who are set apart for God. Then in chapter 7, you have the offering for the dedication of the altar. You have these various individuals giving offerings here with regard to the dedication of the altar. And then in 8, you have the purification or cleansing of the Levites. And finally in 9, you have the commemoration of the Passover. Now it's very significant that God waited until the Passover was commemorated before telling them, now you're ready to go on. And then a statement about the cloud. And we'll come to those in just a few moments. In other words, and this involves the dominant materials here, and this goes clear back to what's happening in Leviticus and what was happening in Exodus 19 to 40. This involves divine, spiritual matters. It's important to be in right relationship with God in order to be assured that you will be able to move toward Canaan and take Canaan and remain loyal to God once you get there. So in terms of the law of proportion, what the emphasis is, and especially when you take into account all of this material here, which also is territory, the great emphasis lies here and not here. Now both are involved. So you have in the Old Testament, as you have in the New Testament, synergism. God and human beings working together. God doesn't say, now don't be concerned about having soldiers to fight or knowing how many soldiers you have or being concerned about military strategy, etc. No, as a matter of fact, in the book of Joshua, you have probably the best military strategy ever devised for taking that area. And it's still being used, by the way. So there is military strategy. But there is also, and primarily, what we might call divine strategy, a spiritual strategy. Because no matter what the military and physical strategy may be, human strategy, that will not get the job done unless God fights for them. Now, let's look at the strategic area that we pointed out in chapter 9 with regard to these two matters, the emphasis on the Passover. And as I say, God apparently deliberately has them wait until the Passover is commemorated. 1 year following the initial Passover, which happened at the Exodus. Now, we have to ask, why does God wait for the Passover to be commemorated before he has them start out? Anyone? Right.
I think we're going to tie back to the first Passover.
All right, and you recall what we said about remembrance. It isn't merely a matter of refreshing your minds as to what happened in the past, but remembrance involves what? Reliving, reenactment, appropriating the past for the present. Now, the Passover said what with regard to the past? All right. Exactly. In other words, the Passover is a theological statement. It's a statement to the effect that God is the Lord, is Yahweh, and I delivered you from Egypt. And I delivered you from the slaying of the firstborn when you responded, as you say, in faith and obedience. So it's a reminder of the absolute indispensability of God for their triumph, for their victory, for their success. And in effect, the Passover is saying, you cannot rely on yourselves primarily. Now, you've made some preparations here. But you cannot rely primarily on those preparations. Your reliance is primarily a divine, a spiritual reliance. You must rely on me now as you relied on me at the Exodus. And you must respond to me now as you responded at the Exodus. If I am going to be able to be your deliverer again with regard to moving toward Canaan and taking Canaan. So the Passover is a theological statement. And in the reenactment of their past history, they are reminded of the kind of God they have, what he has done for them, and the kind of God they need for the future. What they needed in the past, they need now and in the future. What God has done for them is not merely in the past. It obtains now for the future. Now, the other element that you have here is the cloud. This cloud which covers the tabernacle. And the fire by day, the fire by night. And note the statement in 22 and 23 of chapter 9. Whether it was 2 days or a month or a longer time that the cloud continued over the tabernacle, abiding there, the people of Israel remained in camp and did not set out. But when it was taken up, they set out. At the command of the Lord, they encamped. At the command of the Lord, they set out. They kept the charge of the Lord at the command of the Lord by Moses. Same kind of thing you have, up in verses 17 and 18. So God was their guide, and they were to follow him. When the cloud stood still, it didn't make any difference how long it was, a short time or a long time, they were to stay there. But when the cloud moved, they were to move. Because, again, God is their guide. See? He's a God who goes before them to guide them, and by the way, also to protect them. Because where this cloud is, they will not be defeated if they obey the Lord. See? So the great emphasis then in 9 is by way of capturing this divine spiritual element in their preparation. And those assertions which supplement what has been happening all along and which highlight the role of God in the life of Israel and pass over the cloud, these are dominant in their preparation for traveling and for conquest. Are we clear now on what we've found there by way of answering, beginning to answer those questions that we raised? And you see how, when you get into the study of the parts, you begin answering your survey questions. And finally, you answer them in the synthesis. Okay? You had your hand up back there. I'm sorry. Okay, good. Now, let's look at 13 and 14, this episode when the spies are sent up into Canaan, as we pointed out. They were to do two things. They were to find out what kind of land it was, and in a way, to verify what God had said about it, in terms of a rich land, flowing with milk and honey, etc. Secondly, they were to spy out the fortifications, the forces and the fortifications. How strong are the fighting people? The armies, how strong are the cities, etc. And bring back a report. Now that report is brought back, we're told, in 1325 following, at the end of 40 days. And the group said in 27, Moses, they said to Moses and to Aaron, we came to the land which, to which you sent us. It flows with milk and honey, and this is its fruit. As Moses had indicated, they ought to bring back fruit, and they did. Yet, here's the contrast. Great land, it ought to be taken, but the people who dwell in the land are strong, and the cities are fortified and very large, and besides, we saw the descendants of Anak there. The Amalekites dwell in the land of the Negeb, Hittites, Jebusites, Amorites, Canaanites dwell by the sea along the Jordan. Now, that's fine insofar as it goes. He wanted them to tell him what kind of fortifications there were, what kind of forces there were. But Caleb, who along with Joshua were among these spies, knew what was coming. Caleb quieted the people before Moses and said, let us go up at once and occupy it, for we are well able to overcome it. Now, well able to overcome it how? With the help of the Lord, as he goes on to say. Then the men who had gone up with him said, we are not able to go up against the people, for they are stronger than we. So they brought to the people of Israel an evil report of the land which they had spied out, saying, the land through which we have gone to spy it out is a land that devours its inhabitants, and all the people that we saw in it are men of great stature, and there we saw the Nephilim, and we seemed to ourselves like grasshoppers, and so we seemed to them. Now, you see what their assessment is. Their assessment is essentially a human physical assessment. What is the issue? It is we versus they. That's the basis on which we are to make this judgment as to whether or not we go in to take the land. And when we make this comparison, what we come out with is that we look like grasshoppers to them and to ourselves. You know, these giants, grasshoppers, looking up. Boy, no way can I overtake these giants. I see the human assessment, the physical assessment, and by the way, this is a majority report. Now, the majority is not always right. We've got the mistaken notion in democracy, because you have to go to the majority is the least of evil, but the majority is right. The majority is not always right. The minority is sometimes right. That's why, by the way, we have to listen to minorities. But sometimes they're right. Because the armies and the fortifications were even stronger than that. That's the way they assess it. And that's the way it takes place in the conflict in Joshua. They don't conquer the land because they have superior forces. The story of the fall of Jericho is not based on superior force. It's based on God fighting in their behalf. So, no, and from a physical standpoint, they couldn't do it. No way. Even though they had an excellent strategy, excellent leadership, Joshua and others. The people and fortifications of Canaan were such that they could never have done it on their own. There's a whole story not only here, but in the conquest itself. And by the way, the story of Deuteronomy, too, you're seeing it. By the way, preparing for the conquest. That kind of argument, though, it ought to be thought through, and I think we ought to question the matter of numbers, unless you simply accept these matters as a matter of dogma, the basis of dogma. I think these kinds of judgments are very, very shaky. We don't have all the evidence, archaeological evidence, by which to make judgments as to exactly how many people were either with the Israelites or with the other side, to say nothing of fortifications. After all, it's one thing simply to fight person against person. But when you're fighting against fortified cities, it takes less soldiers to defend the city than it does to take the city. So there are all kinds of variables of this sort. I do not buy the argument that if these numbers are accurate, and we don't have the numbers of the Canaanites, but if these numbers are accurate, it would not have been a miracle. I don't buy that argument. I don't think the evidence is sufficient to support it. Okay, now we have, thank God, a minority report, although we have, first of all, an indication of what happened, because we're told in 14:1 following that the congregation listened to this majority report, and they raised a loud cry, and the people wept that night, and all the people of Israel murmured. Here you have them murmuring, as they had done here. regard to where's the meat, you know? Not where's the beef, but where's the meat, at least. And they got it and came out of their nostrils. And they got so much of it. They murmured against Moses and Aaron, and they said to them, "What would that we had died in the land of Egypt." Just think of it. It would have been better if there had been no Exodus. But we had died back there. Of course, they're assuming they're going to die here. They try to take Canaan. So better die back there and not go through this whole experience. Which makes some sense, assuming they're going to die here. Which, of course, is a wrong assumption. Or would that we had died in the wilderness. Egypt? What? At least in the wilderness before we arrived. Now they question God's motives. Why does the Lord bring us into this land to fall by the sword? The assumption is, no, we're sunk. We're going to be killed. Our wives and our little ones will become a prey. Would it not be better for us to go back to Egypt? Now just think of that. Let's turn around and go back. In fact, they said, let's choose a captain and he'll take us back to Egypt. Now you note the distrust of God, the impugning of wrong motives to God, in spite of all that happened. We saw in the book of Exodus. And for that matter, all that happened subsequently. Then Moses and Aaron, we're told, fell on their faces before all the assembly of the congregation of the people of Israel. And these two spies, this minority, Joshua and Caleb, rent their clothes and said to all the congregation of the people of Israel, the land which we passed through to spy it out is an exceedingly good land. There was agreement on that score among all the spies. Here comes the difference, this minority report. It's not we versus they. The issue is, does the Lord delight in us? If the Lord delights in us, he will bring us into this land and give it to us, a land which flows with milk and honey. Only do not rebel against the Lord. Note the sins that they're talking about, the sin of rebellion. Do not fear the people of the land, sin of fear, when it does not exist. For they are bread for us. Now you see the change of image. The grasshoppers are bread because there's a change in perspective. And the Lord, and their protection is removed from them. That's why this happens. And the Lord, the Lord is with us. Do not fear them. But all the congregation said to stone them with stones. And then the glory of the Lord appears and says, this people will not believe in me. I want to disinherit them. And as a result, of course, you have the judgment of God that's indicated in 29 following. Your dead bodies shall fall in this wilderness, and all of your number, numbered from 20 years old and upward, all of these people who have been counted here in the census, he says, including, by the way, the women as well, who have murmured against me, not one shall come into the land where I swore that I would make you dwell, except for Caleb and Joshua, and for some others like Moses and Aaron and their little ones. So you have the minority report then. Right, Caleb and Joshua, two of these spies, and by the way, later on we're told that 10 spies who were the majority were killed in a plague, and the two, Joshua and Caleb, were spared. And what they do is to emphasize, of course, the spiritual dimension is not we versus they, but the Lord versus they. And when you look at it that way, they are bread for us. No longer grasshoppers, they are bread for us. We'll even eat them up. The issue is, will God delight in us? Will we have a right relationship with God so that he fights on our behalf? That's the issue. So here is the divine and the spiritual emphasis, but of course, that's just the minority. A majority goes along with this. So in effect, what was happening was that the cloud was moving and the people refused to move. That's what happened. The cloud was moving and the people refused to move. And in effect, what the people did was to major in minors and minor in majors. That's what they did. Which indicates what happens when you have the wrong perspective. You can make a radical misjudgment of situations if you look at them from the wrong point of view. That's all it takes. And what happened then in the subsequent materials was that this whole process was reversed in keeping with the preparation. In fact, what you have here in the episodes of 13 and 14 is the denial of the preparation. God says the divine spiritual element is most important, that people said, no, it isn't. It's the human physical element. Now you have a reinstatement of the divine and the spiritual as being most important. Here, and subsequently, by the part that was God who stopped Balaam, not the people, not any human strategy, God who stopped Balaam, God who fought on their behalf with regard to Og and Sion, a very strong king, by the way. So it was the reinstatement of the primacy of the divine and the spiritual which caused the resurgence here and enabled the people to move then towards the Canaan and be ready to take the land at the end of the book. Indeed, you have the Trans-Jordan tribes being settled here toward the end of the book as a result of God's fighting on their behalf. So God is saying, in effect, I am the chief battler. I am the chief one here by way of providing strength for the armies, not you, not your physical, human, military might. They said, no, you aren't. You have to judge these things on human terms. And of course, you have this destruction of this entire generation, virtually. And finally, God's role is reinstated, and when he is, and then it is, he becomes then the one who fights for them and enables them to move toward him. So, the essential message of this book, then, is that when the people of Israel refused to trust God, to obey God, when they were overcome by fear without valid reason, there was tragedy. This is the In the Wilderness book. But when the people obeyed God, recognized his primacy with regard to the taking of the land, then they experienced triumph and victory. So the covenant promises then depend ultimately on the belief and obedience of the people toward God and their right relationship with God. That's what makes the difference in these two cases. Now that's synthesis, you see. And I'm putting together the book as a whole in terms of its primary thrust, as you see, not only in this preparation, in these pivots, but in other episodes where you have obedience leading to triumph and victory and blessing, and disobedience leading to curse. Okay, there's much more that we could do with the book if we had the time, but we don't have the time, so let's stop here and let me ask you if you have any questions now on what we've done. Yes, my thought is that it's just as difficult to understand our own experiences as it is to understand theirs. In other words, we're just as inconsistent as they were. That's the thing that amazes me when I look at myself, when I look at others who've experienced God in the past. They've experienced tremendous victories with God. Who've had occasions to evaluate one's own experience and one's own possibilities in divine, spiritual terms, or against human, physical terms, and have experienced the value of that kind of thing. All of a sudden we turn around and face a particular decision and a particular judgment, and we revert. I think this is a story of the inconsistency and, in a sense, the fickleness, the irrationality of human beings. On the one hand, see what God has done, believe, etc., and then turn around and do the very opposite. on occasions when they have no reason for doing so in light of their past history, their past experience. Now, I think the children had experience with God's provision in the wilderness because they survived in the wilderness only because God helped them. So it wasn't as if they had no experience with God. But I think what they did was, on the basis of that experience, on the basis of learning from their parents in a negative way, learning that what their parents did was wrong, and saying to themselves, on the basis, by the way, of what God and Moses do with them, Deuteronomy, on the basis of that, saying, we're not going to repeat the mistake of our parents. This time we're going in. That's what they do. So I think this is true to human character, and I think what we need to do is see our, not simply say, well, these people were addicted. And I'm not saying you're saying that. It's easy to say that. Just as it's easy to say that a bank. The bank is stupid. After Christ feeds the 5,000, they see it, all that, and then they're with 4,000, and Christ wants the 4,000 fed, and they say, they make the same human physical assessment situation. Now, how can we buy bread in the desert for these people? They say it twice. After they've seen Christ feed the 5,000. No, what's going on here? And that's what goes, but I think if we, you say, look, this is realistic, this is realistic. And look at ourselves, in light of this, we'll find the same thing in ourselves. The same fickleness, the same lack of learning from experience, the same lack of teachableness, lack of openness, et cetera, to God, in spite of what we experienced in the past. So the past never guarantees the future, does it? That's the story of human character. The past never guarantees the future. You can't rest on your past laurels, say, because I'm this kind of person, experience this with God in the past. Now I'm sure I will be this kind of person, experience this with God in the future. No. You have this radical reversal. So the very people who were delivered are now wiped out. That's the way history goes. And the very people who were not delivered end up being delivered. This new generation. So I think this is human character. I don't like to say human nature, but I don't think there's anything fixed about it, anything static about it. It's dynamic. Didn't need to be this way. They could have obeyed God here. As Joshua and Caleb wanted them to do. There's no determinism here. In fact, once when I was discussing Calvinism with a rigid Calvinist, and I insist on going back to the scripture to test from theology, I call attention to this again, because of course he was holding that whatever happened, God wanted. Well, I say that when you look at Numbers 13 and 14, I don't see how in the world you can say that God wanted them to say no with regard to going into Canaan. He was trying to say go. They said, we won't go. So they thwarted God. They disobeyed God. They rebelled against him. That's what the text said. But he couldn't handle that. He was God's word. He's not having a faith. He's saying, describing this as having the kind of mind that's kind of shut. Boom! So there's no point in talking about it. that's what you have here. This dynamism indicates other possibilities. And if they're not followed, it's not because they can't be followed, but because people choose not to follow. Okay. Yeah, I think, though, that it goes beyond understanding, Dixie, because understanding does not guarantee proper action. I think it involves a kind of assimilation, a kind of experience, a kind of acceptance of what the acts of God mean. Not so much saying they mean this or that. You know, they've just gone through the Passover. This means that God can deliver us even against the greatest of odds. There was no way they're getting out of Egypt without the Lord's help. Pharaoh and his armies could have wiped them out in Egypt or at the Sea of Reeds, for that matter. So they just went through this, you know. They said that, yeah, but that was back there. Now the situation is different, you see. So it's this failure that I talked about with regard to the disciples, this failure to remember. Not merely to understand what the past means, but to appropriate it in a new situation. Okay? That's the great problem that these people face, as the disciples face in the gospel.
My mother was hit the rock. But that's such a devious sin that God could not come out at the spot or, you know, why would God so upset when I hit the rock? He didn't say beforehand, don't hit the rock.
Yeah, well, he said, speak and you get the water.
Yeah, well, what I'm asking is, if you do more than what God asked you to do, then that's disobedience.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. As a matter of fact, there's an interesting story at the end chapter 14 with regard to doing more than the Lord asked them concerning the Amorites. And that's, by the way, picked up in Deuteronomy. You know, the Lord had said, go in, and they said, no, we won't go in. Now, in the case of the Amorites, God said, don't go up, and they said, we're going to go up now. See, we've learned our lesson. We didn't go up before, now we're going up. Moses said, don't go up because the Lord won't be with you. Oh, that's not making it. We're going up, see. So yeah, it's, but I would assume that God's judgment is proportionate to the seriousness of the sin. And the judgment was pretty serious. Imagine this man who had led this stiff-necked people for 40 exasperating and exhausting years, being told you can't realize the purpose of all this. Let us go to the land of Canaan. That's a pretty serious judgment. But the sin must be pretty serious. And the sin meant that Moses did not sanctify God in their midst. Which is to say, not only did he not obey God, and it's not a matter of more or less, but it's a matter of doing or not doing what God says. God said, speak. He, probably out of anger against these people, hit the rock. And what I think that meant was that, in effect, the people got the idea that it was Moses who brought the water out of the rock by hitting it. And he did not set God over.